Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is going to be, I believe, episode 174 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in this podcast, I'm going to be continuing the rapid review series for the USMLE Step 1 the USMLE Step 2 CK exam. This will be series 22. Okay, so this is episode 174, series 22. So let's go ahead and get right into it. So what if you get a question about a patient, and this patient has endocarditis, and they tell you that this person has, you know, is like a cattle farmer, and they tell you that, you know, you do like the classic blood cultures and you're not growing anything. What book should you be thinking about under those circumstances? I would really hope that you're thinking about Coxiella bornerii. Okay, remember Coxiella bornerii is a very common cause of culture negative endocarditis. You know, back in the day where there was this stuff with the HSEC organism, so like Haemophilus, Actinobacillus, Cardiobacterium, Eikenella, and Kingella. But they usually don't go there on NBME exams these days. They now go after like weird exotic things like Coxiella bornerii. Remember, Coxiella tends to cause like Q fever, right? So again, that's a big thing you want to keep at the back of your mind for tests. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that this patient has a history of like carcinoid syndrome, and this person has, you know, become forgetful, and this person's caused like a 20 out of 30 on a mini mental status exam, and this person, you know, has been having like chronic diarrhea, and this person, you know, has like these like skin, like these weird rashes on the skin. What are you thinking about under those circumstances? Well, I would really hope that you're thinking about pellagra, right? So because this person has carcinoid syndrome, remember, if a person has carcinoid syndrome, it essentially involves the person making having a tumor. Usually it's in the small bowel, usually in the appendix, that's making a ton of serotonin. And that serotonin, remember, serotonin, another name for serotonin is 5-HT or 5-hydroxytryptophan. So the thing that's essentially happening is that you're converting tryptophan to serotonin. But remember that tryptophan is also needed for the production of niacin. So if a person has serotonin syndrome and you're consuming all their tryptophan in the production of serotonin, then you will have less tryptophan, aka feedstock, available for the production of niacin. And that can ultimately cause problems for the patient, right? That can cause the 4 Ds of pellagra, which in this case will be diarrhea, right? Dermatitis, dementia, and death. So those are all high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind with exams. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient, and this patient, you know, they tell you that this patient has was initially complaining of, let's say this patient has like a history of like, let's say they've had like some kind of like abdominal surgery, and then they tell you that this person, you know, has been having like fevers, and this person has not been passing flatus, and this person has been having like a lot of vomiting. So basically like signs and symptoms of a small bowel obstruction. And then they tell you that this person, you know, keeps having like abdominal distension. And then they tell you that, oh, that all of a sudden, the person loses consciousness, becomes profoundly hypotensive, and dies. And then they tell you that when they obtain imaging, like maybe let's say they obtain like emergent imaging or something, and they notice like bowel contents all strewn around the GI tract, what's your diagnosis there? What genetic condition does that person have? Well, I would really hope that you're thinking about something along the lines of Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, right? So the thing is, classically, right, when people think of Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, all they think about are the cardiac issues that they can have. So, you know, most people tend to think about like, oh, this person has Ehlers-Danlos, which is like, you know, it can be like a type 3 or a type 5 collagen defect. And they're like, oh, okay, this person can have like aortic dissection, because remember, it's a connective tissue disorder, or they can have like a thoracic aortic aneurysm, or they can have like a mitral valve prolapse. Those are like the big things people have come to associate with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. But the thing is, in general, in Ehlers-Danlos, those people can actually have like essentially like explosion of their small bowels, right? So that's actually a very high yield thing you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. They can have explosions of their small bowels, right? So they like, isn't it like their small bowel just literally explodes? Because again, they have issues with collagen, so they don't have like strong membranes surrounding their small bowels, right? So that can be a common complication. So generally, you want to like think twice about like if a person has Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, like some classic things you may, or unusual things, I guess I'll put it that way, some unusual things you may see on an MBME exam is, you want to be careful with these people becoming pregnant. I mean, typically you try to like either like offer like very early C-sections, right? And again, if they have like any abdominal process that can cause distension, you absolutely want to be careful with those people, right? Because again, you don't want their small bowels to explode. Again, that's something that's very high yields to know for the purposes of MBME exams. And remember that Ehlers-Danlos syndrome is inherited in an autosomal dominant fashion. And people that also have Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, believe it or not, they can also have aneurysms in the circle of Willis, right? Which can cause a subarachnoid hemorrhage when it ruptures. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient, and let's say this patient, they tell you that the person has, how do I put this? So let's say this person has like a history of hereditary spherocytosis, but you notice that on labs, the person's MCV is like 110. What is the most likely cause of that person's elevated MCV? I mean, obviously, you know that that's a macrocytic anemia, but what's the cause under those circumstances? Well, I would really hope that you're thinking along the lines of, I don't know why I'm having these blanks. So I would hope you're thinking along the lines of, like a folate deficiency. I don't know what's going on. Maybe it's because of this headache I have. But you're thinking more along the lines of a folate deficiency. Remember that folate is known as vitamin B9. And you can actually run out of your folate a lot faster than you can run out of your B12. So they'll try to trick you on the exam with a B12 deficiency as the cause of the person's macrocytic anemia. Resist that temptation. The person likely has a folate deficiency as the cause of their macrocytic anemia. And I guess because they essentially have issues with DNA synthesis, if you want to be a little more specific, those people have a megaloblastic anemia. So again, those are all actually high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. People that classically get folate deficiencies are people that have like a history of like a macrocytic, of a hemolytic anemia. So hemolytic anemias tend to be associated with a folate deficiency, right? So like this person that has hereditary spherocytosis has a hemolytic anemia. So they can give you the same thing in a person that has like sickle cell disease, or in a person that has like one of the thalassemias, right? Essentially anything that causes a hemolytic anemia can ultimately lead to a folate deficiency. This is why people that have hemolytic anemias need to get daily folate supplementation. Also remember, if you see a macrocytic anemia in an alcoholic, you also again want to think about a folate deficiency, because the enzyme that helps you reabsorb folate in the duodenum of the GI tract is actually inhibited. Sorry, I have a small headache. I don't know. I think that may be sort of like messing with my head a little here, but the enzyme that helps you reabsorb folate in the GI tract, that enzyme is poisoned by alcohol, right? So that's why alcoholics tend to develop a folate deficiency. Now, what if you get a question about a patient, and this patient, you know, they've smoked like half a pack of cigarettes every day for like 10 years, and they tell you that this patient is like 35 years old, and this patient comes in because he has been having like increased sputum production, and they tell you that this person is, you know, has been having like increased sputum production, a lot of cough, and then they tell you that on imaging of the chest, like on a chest x-ray or like a CT scan of the chest, you notice that this person has like hyperinflation, like mild, not severe, mild hyperinflation of the lungs. And then they tell you that the person's uncle died of some liver problem about 20 or 30 years ago. What diagnosis are you thinking about under those circumstances? Well, I would really hope that you're thinking about a patient with alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, right? Remember, alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, it's inherited in an autosomal codominant fashion, right? And when people have alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, they tend to have liver problems and lung problems, right? Because, and if, I mean, if you think about the pathophysiology, remember A1AT deficiency, right? Alpha-1 antitrypsin, it's an anti-protease, right? So it essentially protects your lung from degradation by proteases, right? So if you have a deficiency of an anti-protease, then that means the proteases will hold sway, and that can essentially cause an emphysema, okay? That can cause a pan-acinar emphysema. So that's, again, a classic presentation on the USMLE exams. One thing I will tell you is they may occasionally try to trick you with a patient that's like a teenager or a patient that's in like their 20s, and they will try to get you to think of alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency as the cause of their lung pathology. I will strongly encourage you to not go with that. Even if a person has alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, yes, that increases their risk of having like early onset emphysema. But the thing is, that emphysema typically shows up in their late 30s or early 40s. It doesn't show up like super early, like a patient having emphysema essentially in their 20s on the USMLE exams. So I'd be very wary of that if I were you when you're taking tests. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient that presents with like, you know, they tell you that, you know, they've been having fatigue for the last couple of months. And let's say this patient has smoked like, you know, two packs of cigarettes every day for like 15 years. And this patient is like a 53-year-old male. And then they give you like a CBC. And you notice that this patient's MCV is like 65 and the patient's hemoglobin is 8. What is your next best step in management for this patient? Well, I would really hope you're saying to go ahead and perform a colonoscopy, right? So remember, whenever you see a microcytic anemia in a person that is over 50 years old, right? You always want to entertain the, getting a colonoscopy, right? Because they may have colon cancer as the cause of their microcytic anemia, okay? So a colonoscopy is the next best step in management under those circumstances. One other thing your friends at the MBME love to do occasionally is, they may give you a question about a patient that, you know, comes in with like, you know, left lower quadrant pain and fever. You know, obviously that's diverticulitis, right? And the first thing you would want to do for those people is you want to get a CT scan of the abdomen with IV contrast, right? So you get a CT scan of the abdomen with IV contrast, you make the diagnosis. One thing you should not forget to do is that weeks after, about, you know, about 6 weeks after that episode of diverticulitis, you absolutely positively want to make sure that you obtain a colonoscopy to rule out colon cancer. Because remember, sometimes colon cancer can present like diverticulitis. That's something that's classically known as pseudo-diverticulitis, okay? So that's one thing you want to try to rule out, right? So you get a colonoscopy weeks after they've had, like essentially after the acute episode of diverticulitis has resolved. Do not do a colonoscopy during the acute phase of a diverticulitis, because that can increase the person's risk of colonic perforation, and you absolutely do not want that. So again, that's a big thing, big picture thing you want to keep at the back of your mind on exams. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient, you know, that has like lung cancer, and you know, this patient was started on pharmacologic therapy, and then this patient starts complaining of like a pins and needles sensation in their upper and lower extremities. What's the drug that this patient was placed on? I would really hope you're thinking about like the vinca alkaloids, right? So like vincristine and vinblastine. Remember, those drugs inhibit polymerization of microtubules, and they tend to be associated with peripheral neuropathy as a side effect, okay? So if you ever see peripheral neuropathy as a side effect of an anti-cancer medication, yes, don't get me wrong, there are many anti-cancer medications that can cause peripheral neuropathy, but the only one I want you to think about on MBME exams are the vinca alkaloids like vincristine or vinblastine. Other drug classes you could potentially consider are things like your taxanes, right? So like paclitaxel and docetaxel. Remember, those work more with preventing the depolymerization of microtubules, okay? So those are the drugs that you want to keep at the back of your mind. But really, the big, big one I really want you to think about when you're talking about MBME exams are the vinca alkaloids like vincristine and vinblastine. Now, what if you get a question about a patient and this patient, you know, recently started treatment for some kind of malignancy, and then they tell you that this patient has, like, over the last, let's say this patient started this treatment for like some kind of colon cancer, right? And then this patient recently has started having like shortness of breath, and this patient is, you know, having like a dry cough. So like dry cough, shortness of breath. And then they tell you that, oh, in worry, they obtain like a CT scan of the chest. And then they tell you that you see increased interstitial markings on chest imaging. What kind of drug was this patient recently started on? Well, I would really hope you're thinking about actually one of like, you know, like three options. So something like busulfan, right? Or bleomycin or methotrexate, okay? Busulfan, bleomycin or methotrexate, right? Because this person very likely has pulmonary fibrosis in the setting of either like busulfan, bleomycin or methotrexate toxicity. And remember that when a person has pulmonary fibrosis, right, they will essentially present with a restrictive lung disease picture. So if you measure their FEV1 to FVC ratios, it'll be normal or mildly increased on an MBME exam, right? And those increased interstitial markings I'm referring to is just essentially the lung fibrosis that the person has undergone from taking one of these agents, right? The thing is, cancer drugs and their side effects are very, very high yield to know for the purposes of the USMLE exams, right? So don't forget your bleomycin, your busulfan, and your methotrexate as causes of pulmonary fibrosis in the setting of anti-cancer therapy. And some key things you actually want to know with those drugs, right? You want to know that bleomycin specifically works in the G2 phase of the cell cycle, right? And then you want to know that methotrexate works by inhibiting the enzyme dihydrofolate reductase, okay? Dihydrofolate reductase. So by inhibiting dihydrofolate reductase, that will mess up DNA synthesis and that will prevent proliferation of the malignancy. Although, you also want to store in the back of your mind that if a person has like a profound bone marrow suppression from taking methotrexate, right, what is the drug of choice to rescue those people's bone marrow? I would hope you're telling me leucovorin, right? Remember, leucovorin is a folinic acid analog that is used to reverse the bone marrow suppressive toxicity of methotrexate. And the thing is, the MDME knows that most human beings have memorized this factoid of methotrexate causing bone marrow suppression and rescuing with leucovorin. So occasionally, they actually begin to present some more exotic scenarios of bone marrow suppression from folate inhibitors that are not methotrexate, but you also still need to rescue those people's bone marrows with leucovorin. So they can give you a question about a patient, for example, that is on like trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole prophylaxis for like pneumocystis jirovetii in the setting of HIV. And the thing people forget is that, well, trimethoprim is also an inhibitor of dihydrofolate reductase, so it can also cause bone marrow suppression, right? So if a person has bone marrow suppression from taking Bactrim, you also rescue those people's bone marrows with leucovorin. Another nifty way they can present that on MBME exams is they can give you a question about a patient that has a history of HIV, right? And with that history of HIV, you know, they may tell you that, oh, this person has been complaining of headache and this person has like seizures and all that bad stuff going on. And then they tell you that, oh, this person was, you know, they did like imaging of the brain and they found like multiple ring enhancing lesions. So you're like, oh crap, this person potentially has toxoplasmosis. Well, if a person has toxoplasmosis, right, the treatment of choice is pyrimethamine and sulfadiazine, okay? Well, don't forget, pyrimethamine is also an inhibitor of dihydrofolate reductase. So that can, again, cause a profound bone marrow suppression, and you rescue that person's bone marrow with leucovorin, which, again, like I said, it's not a folic acid analog, it's a folinic acid analog. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient that has a latex allergy, and they ask you, what is the biggest risk factor for this patient's latex allergy? What kind of answer choice do you want to pick? Well, you will actually want to pick an answer choice that relates to either being a healthcare worker or having a prolonged exposure to the healthcare system, okay? Basically, anything that puts you in a position to get exposed to like just like gloves, that can increase your risk of having a latex allergy, right? In fact, one nifty way they can present that on an MBME exam is they can give you a question about a patient that has a predisposing condition that just essentially puts them in the healthcare system all the time. For example, It can be a person that has some kind of like genetic disease, like cystic fibrosis, where they will have to go to the hospital multiple times to get treatment for one exacerbation or the other, okay? If you see that, think about those things as the biggest risk factors for latex allergies. And please don't forget that latex allergy is a type 1 hypersensitivity reaction, okay? Latex allergy is a type 1 hypersensitivity reaction. They'll try to mess with your head by giving you type 4 because it kind of sounds like a contact dermatitis, right? But resist that temptation on your USMLE exams. If a person has a latex allergy, that is actually a type of type 1 hypersensitivity reaction. In fact, to round out today, I don't know, this headache, I probably need to take some medication, but let me maybe wrap this up real quick and kind of move on, but kind of like end this podcast. But when a person has a type 1 hypersensitivity reaction, right, those are things like asthma, right, or any kind of allergy, right? So if a person has like an anaphylactic reaction with a blood transfusion, right, in the setting of like IgA deficiency, for example, that's an example of a type 1 hypersensitivity reaction. Remember, type 1 hypersensitivity reactions are IgE mediated, okay? So you get exposed to the allergen, that binds to IgE that is already on the surface of like a mast cell, for example, and then you have cross-linking of those IgE antibodies, and then that mast cell will degranulate and release all this badness that can then cause those symptoms that the patient has. That's one. Now, a type 2 hypersensitivity reaction, that classically presents from making autoantibodies against a specific cell type, okay? Making autoantibodies against a specific cell type. For example, if a person has ITP, immune thrombocytopenic purpura, where they make autoantibodies against GP2B3A, that's an example of a type 2 hypersensitivity reaction. If a person makes antibodies against like a red blood cell antigen, so like autoimmune hemolytic anemia, that's also an example of a type 2 hypersensitivity reaction. Now, a type 3 hypersensitivity reaction revolves more around forming an antigen-antibody complex, right? So if you see like a vasculitis or like the most of like the nephritic syndromes or like serum sickness, that classically is an example of a type 3 hypersensitivity reaction. And then the final one, the type 4 hypersensitivity reaction, right? You want to think about things like contact dermatitis, where, you know, a person plays in like a forest or like a wooded area or whatever, and then they have like these skin lesions afterwards, right? That's a delayed type hypersensitivity reaction. Another classic one may be like a nickel allergy, a contact dermatitis from like nickel. Think about a type 4 hypersensitivity reaction under those circumstances. Also like the TB skin test. Those are all examples of type 4 hypersensitivity reactions. And really the way you treat type 4 hypersensitivity reactions is just avoid the thing that triggered it in the first place. So I'm going to go ahead and pause here so I can go take some ibuprofen. I know what's going on with this headache. But as I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for many exams. Step 1, 2CK, 2CS, Step 3, preclinical med school exams, third year shelf exams. There's the USMLE booster course that I've talked about ad nauseum. I offer tutoring for that. I do that for like step 1, step 2CK, step 3. It's good for a person at the end of their dedicated periods. It's like 10 hours for step 2CK and step 3 and 20 hours for step 1. And then if you're a medicine resident, I offer one-on-one tutoring for the in-training exam and the board exam, the ABIMA board exam. And then I've also, again, talked about like the longitudinal tutoring that I offer, where if you're a first, second, or third year med student, I tutor for like your block exams or your shelf exams and your upcoming USMLE exam. And then I also tutor like college students that need tutoring for like Gen Chem, O Chem, Physics, Biochem, Physiology, Histology. I tutor for all those things. And then finally, if you're a med student applying to residency, so like an ERAS app, or a college student applying to med school, so an AMCAS app, I do offer like one-on-one advising, or you could call this coaching, for those exams, for those applications, right? So like rec letters, personal statement writing, editing applications, mock interviews. I've worked with tons of people on those things. And again, the vast majority of them have been successful in their residency pursuits or like med school pursuits. Again, I have like admissions committee experience. I've been on an admissions committee for a year at a top 2 med school. So again, I have experience reading thousands of high quality applications. So have a wonderful rest of your day. I'm going to go ahead and stop here. I'll see you in the next podcast. Thank you. God bless you.